This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Eugene Kennedy, left the priesthood to marry. He believes that celibacy should be optional and that priests should be allowed to marry. He's thought a lot about sexuality and the church, including the current sexual abuse scandal. Kennedy is the author of The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. He's a psychologist who has counseled many priests, and he headed the psychological panel of a multidisciplinary study of the American priesthood that was commissioned by the country's Catholic bishops. Kennedy is professor emeritus of psychology at Loyola University.
You were a priest for 22 years. You've been married for 25.
Right. And think I'm doing better at one than the other?
You left the priesthood in order to marry. How did getting married win out over staying in the priesthood? How did you make that decision?
Well, you know, when we speak about love in the English language, we say you fall in love. And that's a very interesting way of putting it, because you can't inch your way into love. You can't talk your way into it. You have to fall. You have to let go. And if you are in love with someone, as I was fortunate enough to fall in love, that as an experience caused me to come in conflict with the priesthood, which required me not to be married. I was very happy as a priest. And actually, in many ways, my life didn't change very much. I was still a professor, still a writer and a lecturer. And while I regret that that choice had to be made, I am not at all unhappy that I made it.
When you first became a priest, how did you feel about facing a celibate life?
Well, I became a priest in an age when there were tremendous social supports for the priesthood that no longer exist. The general American culture was intact. The Catholic culture within that general American culture was very close-knit and gave great support to those who entered the seminary and came back to serve their people in the priesthood in one way or the other. The change in the general culture and in the Catholic culture, of course, have had a big effect on the culture of the priesthood since that time. I feel that I was enjoyed being a priest. I would continue to enjoy being a priest. But the prospect of marriage was not one that within that culture and within the general American culture seemed nearly as attractive at the time I was in the seminary as was pursuing the ideal of the priesthood.
What's your understanding of the history of celibacy in the Catholic Church?
Well, celibacy has been an ideal of various kinds in throughout all of history, and has certainly been identified in the early days of the Church, especially in certain monastic settings and so forth, or certain very special forms of life. But the first pope, of course, was married, and that is not at all outside the tradition of the popes. There are many popes who have been married, and the whole Eastern Orthodox Church is part of the Catholic Church, but its priests have been married. So it is a long history that in the Roman Church was changed by the pope known as Hildebrand, who introduced this as a discipline required of all priests, not so much for ascetic reasons, although it is not without its ascetic properties, even in secular appraisals of it, but in order to control the passage by inheritance of lands and prevent that from happening in the way that priests might hand on what they had gained during their lifetime to their children, and so have it pass out of the control of the church itself. That is why it's called a discipline. It is to control a problem that was economic and sociological rather than to bring some sort of spiritual additive to the priesthood.
When you became a priest, what was your understanding of the reason that celibacy is demanded of priests?
It was proposed in the seminary, not as it was found in history, but as that which made you available to more people than you would be available to if you were married and had a family to whom you had to return every evening and whose concerns would naturally preoccupy you during the day. That is the kind of ideal that Cesar Chavez, the famous farm worker leader whom I knew, spoke to me about once. He said that the farm workers liked to have their priests celibate because, he said, then we really had a feeling that they belonged to us and to our communities. So there are many aspects of it that are very honored in the way that good priests live this life. And that was very much the emphasis that it was given, that it wasn't that you were giving up human relationships, is that you were giving them up in a certain specific way in order to be able to relate to the whole family of the community that you would be serving in an intimate way.
Did you ever see celibacy as an ascetic approach in the way that, say, fasting is? And many people who've fasted over a long period of time say that it can help you achieve an almost altered state, an almost mystical state. Is celibacy connected to that in any way, in your understanding?
Celibacy only means that you're unmarried. There is a good deal of collateral literature that tries to romanticize it into a theologically extraordinary state, but I believe very few people experience it in that fashion. Many years later, when I was the chairman of the psychological panel for the National Conference of Bishops in a multidisciplinary study we did of the priesthood, we examined how priests, in fact, did live their celibate lives. What we discovered was that most American priests, this was after Vatican II had concluded when we did these interviews and drew up this report for the bishops, American priests, we found, observed their celibacy quite well. Those who were healthy men, it takes a very healthy person to lead a celibate life, however. I will return to that in a moment. But even in the healthiest of priests, those who are living very full lives, those who were very active and would fulfill surely the ideal that Cesar Chavez had of the priests belonging to the whole community, they adapted themselves to celibacy. They adjusted to it rather than making it the focus of some sort of effulgent state of grace. They adjusted to it the way that an early widower would have to adjust to not being married, or the way that a confirmed bachelor might after many years. We found that they accepted it, bore such inconveniences and difficulties as it brought with it. It brought also certain conveniences with it, for that matter.
Like what?
Well, I believe it drew a certain amount of respect to them. They were thought to stand in a neutral corner when they were working with people. Their sacrifice was somewhat over-idealized. But this did bring them a measure of respect within the community, which brought them not only tipped hats and gratitude, but many signs of social support and welcome in the homes of people that were very real and very true and therefore very supportive for them.
You would like to see both celibate and married priests?
I believe that celibacy has a real role in general life, as I said before, and certainly in the priesthood. There are wonderful celibate priests serving generously who have honored all their commitments all their lives. They are living under the shadow of this terrible crisis. It's very demoralizing and a terrible thing for them. I think we should ratify their choice of celibacy, but I think that in the future it should be something that they are free to make themselves if they wish, but it should not be a discipline that is demanded of people who may not understand enough about themselves to make that choice at that time. Freely chosen, I believe it can be a wonderful expression of generous hearts. Enforced on people as a condition, it can be something that incubates the kinds of problems that we have seen become so floridly infectious before us in recent months.
My guest is Eugene Kennedy. He's a former priest and the author of the book The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is Eugene Kennedy. He was a priest for 22 years. He left in order to marry. He's been married for 25 years. He's also the author of the book The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. You not only headed up this multidisciplinary study of the American priesthood, you've worked as a clinical psychologist, as a layperson, and your clients have included many priests, some of whom were struggling with sexual issues.
Yes.
A lot of people are wondering whether celibacy is related in any way to the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church now. With all this, with the study that you did and with your work as a psychologist counseling priests, do you see any connection between celibacy and the sexual abuse problem?
Well, I do not believe that celibacy in itself causes sexual abuse any more than marriage in itself causes divorce. But marriage is certainly involved in divorce, and celibacy can be involved in a certain way, at least a pseudo-celibacy, as a veil in a way behind which an underdeveloped person may, without any sort of stress, any real thought of ever being married, may move into the priesthood and bring with him the baggage that he has never opened before he enters the real world and works with other people. That is the real problem that I believe celibacy may be associated with, this problem, not so much as a causative agent, but as this veil behind which these people pass for having resolved the challenges that go with it.
What do you mean by underdeveloped person? And what's an example of a type of problem a so-called underdeveloped person might have that would lead them to choose the celibate life, perhaps for the wrong reason?
By an underdeveloped person, I mean we found in the studies that we did, there were certain groups of men who entered the priesthood who had not completed what was needed for the various growth stages that we all have to pass through to become adults. They might have looked adult from the outside, but internally, their internal growth did not match their chronological age. Typically, they had not worked out the challenges of adolescence and were functioning at a prepubescent level. That meant that they might have made friends with the same sex, but they had not passed through that chum stage in order to reach that level where they could make relationships with the opposite sex. These people are very ill-prepared, therefore, to deal with the challenges of celibacy because they are so far back in the growth cycle on understanding themselves and the way they relate to other people that the idea of relating to a woman is so far beyond them as to be excluded altogether. These are the kind of people who are particularly vulnerable, therefore, to having breakdowns marked by sexual misbehavior once they were out in the priesthood and no longer had the supports of the seminary to prop them up.
You've said that in your work as a clinical psychologist, that with many of the priests who you were seeing, you heard more sadness than sin in their troubling stories. What do you mean?
Well, I think that in most of these stories, even in some of the terrible stories we hear today, one of the elements that we have put aside somewhat is trying to understand how these things could have happened in the first place. How, as you put it earlier, these people who had taken a vow of chastity could have acted out as sexual predators and done such harm to other individuals. Right now we're in a kind of, as they have a punitive stage in a trial, we're in a punitive stage in dealing with this problem. People are trying to find out some way to punish these people adequately. But the question remains, how did this happen in the first place? That question has not been asked by the bishops, but it is the question. The bishops are meeting in Dallas in June, and they are meeting largely to prescribe punishments for a problem that they have not defined and that they give no evidence of understanding. This is a recipe for a tragedy. What we do not understand is what can harm you. What we do not understand about the sexual problems in the priesthood is what has harmed us and harmed, unfortunately, many innocent people, perhaps beyond any numbering of them. I believe that these churchmen should, in fact, ask this question: how could this have ever come to be in people supposedly trained for selfless lives? What is it about the way we recruit them, the way we train them, the way we assign them, whatever questions that might bring them closer to the truth would be the most important questions they have asked. They have avoided asking this question, but it is still the pressing question. If they do not get some information about the causes, they should not spend any time trying to deal with cleaning up the effects.
As a psychologist, what kind of questions, what kind of approach do you think the church could take to screening out candidates for the priesthood who aren't sexually mature, who can't really handle the celibate life, or who aren't even prepared for a sexual life?
Well, I think we should junk the whole system that we have.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe that. I believe this problem is systemic, that it is so inbred in the system of recruiting young people in adolescence or even now later in life and trying to force them into an old-fashioned seminary system that cannot be tinkered with any further. That should be put aside, and we should return to another way of recruiting people to serve in the priesthood. We should also have a broader vision of those who may serve in the priesthood. There certainly should be some consideration given to allowing women to be priests, for example. When I say junk the whole system, I don't mean that we should cavalierly put aside sensible things, but there is a certain time in which you are convinced that this isn't working and we have to do something new. The something new that I would advocate is actually something old, and that is to allow the Christian communities to choose themselves those who will celebrate the Eucharist and the other sacraments for them. St. Augustine, one of the great figures of all Christian and world history, became a priest because his community drafted him, in effect, for the job. The community of ordinary people is very wise. They can tell who's genuine and who is not, who is grown and who is not, and who has the demeanor that they would look for in someone who would be their priest. You have to put aside all these other artificial distinctions that he must be male, that he must be unmarried, and so forth.
I assume that you have served as a psychologist for priests who were having sexual problems, who either were or were potential abusers. What kind of work could you do with them to either prevent that from happening or to prevent it from happening any further?
Well, I don't think that these people can be remade. Not many of us can be remade, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that there are certain treatments that can help them observe their own behavior, cognitive and behavioral therapies, for example, that allow them to monitor themselves and learn how to control these problems and learn how to find other substitute activities that will keep the balance within their lives such that they may be able to continue to work constructively, perhaps not directly with children, but in other ways within the priesthood. We're not going to remake any of these people now, and it may be that for many of them, the best thing would be to try to find a way to allow them to leave the priesthood, perhaps still work in some way within the church, as they say in the police department, desk jobs for those who can no longer effectively work on the street. There are lots of things that can be done, but there is no idea that you can remake these people. I don't think any therapists would propose that.
You are a former priest who still has a lot of criticisms of the church. What keeps you in the church?
Well, the church is, as you will note in the interviews and in the polls, even in cities such as Boston or now Louisville, which have been terribly stricken by this problem of sexual abuse by its priests, the people make a distinction between the church as their family, the church as the source of the sacraments, and the church as an organization. And the church as a family is what most people like very much. They feel it is a family, and every family has problems. And this family is having big problems right now. But these ordinary people realize that it isn't the church that is the source of their spiritual support. the source of the sacraments. That's not the church that's in crisis. It's the church as an organization, and specifically as an hierarchical organization, that is in crisis. They have kept their faith in Catholicism, but they have lost their confidence in the leaders of the organized church. That is really what this crisis is all about. It has much less to do with these poor priests who get into this problem than it has to do with these bishops who have failed to manage this crisis, who have failed to identify and address it, who have allowed it to grow, and even with good hearts that many of them surely have found that now their own authority is the real victim of this difficult time. The bishops who go to Houston have to understand that the problem they're dealing with is not sexual abuse, it's their own authority and their own capacity to function as leaders in the Catholic Church. That is really what is the great crisis through which we are passing now.
Eugene Kennedy is a former priest and the author of The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. He's professor emeritus of psychology at Loyola University. This is Fresh Air.